MacCast, Saturday, October 26th, 2019. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. How you doing? I've been having a pretty decent week, been a little bit busy around here. Looking through the show notes today, looks like we have a number of great things to talk about regarding Apple, although one thing that didn't happen, and I'm a little bit curious about, and I'm curious to get your take on it. So we'll talk about why we're here at the end of October and we're maybe missing a product announcement. We're also going to get into the future of some of Apple's products, what's going to be beyond iPhone, talk about possibilities there. We'll get into iPhone 11 and how well it's doing, little Apple Pay news, Actually, I was going to say some information on Apple TV, but a lot of stuff regarding Apple TV Plus on the cusp of that being released. And then a little cautionary tale, a PSA for those of you who might have older iPhones out there. That'll round out the news. Then we're going to get into some of your feedback. Got some great feedback, a little bit of a follow-up on downloading older versions of macOS, something that I talked about on the last episode of MacCast. I have a little correction or a little fix for some of you who ran into some issues. So we'll get into that. We'll talk about iPhone 11 and possible issues people are having. Not really sure on this one. Did get something from a member of the community, so I had been avoiding kind of a topic, but we'll get into it. We'll talk about some trouble people are having with their iPhone 11, talk about night mode on iPhones, and then again, Apple TV Plus. It's coming soon. How do you get a hold of it? And that will round out this episode of the MacCast. So should be a great episode. Looking forward to diving in, and we won't waste any time. We'll just get right into it. So what is next? What is beyond iPhone? This is a question that I've been wondering, a lot of us in our community have been wondering about. And one of those possibilities is Apple doing an AR headset. We've been hearing about this for a long time. It's been in development, rumored to be in development, either AR or VR headset for years now. The question has always been, when will we actually see this product? Well, it could possibly be in next year, if you want to believe Bloomberg's Mark Gurman. He says it could happen next year, although he hedges his bets a little bit and says it could get pushed back depending upon what's going on. What is it going to be? What is it going to look like? That's another big question. It's looking like it's going to be a accessory, and I don't think that's any big surprise. Something that will actually pair with your iPhone, kind of like your AirPods, although a lot more complex, right? We're talking about glasses, VR headset, sort of heads-up display. He says it will pair wirelessly with your iPhone, display information like messages, email, maps, directions. When I started reading about this, I got little tinges, a little maybe bad feeling in the pit of my stomach that it sounded a little bit like Google Glass, and we all know how that went. That didn't go so well. I think the problem there, though, was the camera, and we're not hearing that these would have a camera on them. They would be purely informational displays helping to augment information that you might get coming in on your iPhone, and I think that's absolutely the right approach. He also talks about the fact that there might be possible applications for gaming. We know ARKit has brought a lot of really cool augmented reality gaming kind of things to the iPhone. I don't know how you feel about these. I'd be curious to get your take on it because I've played a lot with some of the AR games and they're fun and interesting. I think there's a lot of creative things happening, but when they're sort of viewed through the window of the iPhone screen, I think something about the experience is lost a little bit. So I think the idea of doing this actually with a headset, where you kind of take that window or frame that you have to hold up of the iPhone and you're sort of looking through this thing and bring it more into a first person visual experience, I think that's really where this kind of technology takes off. And that's why I'm thinking that Apple thinks this is kind of the next iteration of the iPhone, right? The iPhone, for most of us these days, is not so much about phone calls. It's about all of the information that we have instant access to. And we've been talking about for a while that really the next step is moving away from the display. Obviously, you need to have some sort of visual information in front of you, but getting a piece of glass out of the way, a display out of the way, feels like the next iteration of this. And the question is how do you pull this off? Another thing mentioned in the piece is that there will be a dedicated app store, so new apps for developers to put together. And, you know, right now it seems like this is the direction Apple will move in. The question becomes, how can they make the sort of killer application for this? The piece does go on to note that one of the possible reasons for delay is that Apple does not have the right use case for this. It's like, how does this fit into our lives? How is it seamless and non-intrusive? I think there's a lot of social questions to answer around the idea of augmented reality headsets. Where does privacy fall in this? This is a big question for Apple. So all of these things could potentially delay the release of the product. But again, we know this is something that has been in active development internally at Apple. They're trying to figure it out. And if we know anything about Apple, they won't rush something to market. So that's where I have a little less fear that this will wind up like something like Google Glass. Google Glass felt very much like a public R&D experiment for Google, and they learned a lot from it, I think. And a lot of it was not very positive in terms of the social side of these kinds of products. And I think Apple doesn't want to make those same mistakes. They want to really know that this is something that is going to be accepted by consumers and adopted very quickly. It's what they need. It's, you know, the kind of product they need to replace the iPhone. So it's going to be interesting to see if we get this next year. To me, that feels a little bit aggressive. I would be surprised if it comes out, but all signs right now seem to be pointing to that. We're hearing a lot from analysts and people who are watching Apple saying they are trying to get this as sort of the next big thing. So this, and I guess maybe some of their car stuff, but this feels more like the consumer side of what's next for Apple. A few other things that were mentioned in the piece, he did talk about what might be next for Apple Watch, including sleep tracking. That's something we've been talking about for a little bit here on the MacCast. And then also that we could see next year a Mac with a custom Apple processor. Another big story that's been talked about is, when is Apple going to do, you know, move away from Intel, get their own chips inside Macs? I kind of feel like MacBook Air feels like the product that might get that, sort of this hybrid between iPad OS and a Mac, and could be ripe for that kind of processor. There's been kind of a counter argument too, that Apple could go very high end with their own processors and build them out for a Mac Pro, which I think is a very interesting thought, because Apple sells fewer of those devices, so it'd be kind of a more controlled environment for them to push their own silicone designs and processors into. Feels highly ambitious, though, right? It feels like a much easier transition to move from an iPad Pro, iPad OS into something like a MacBook Air, sort of an entry-level thing. So it'll be interesting to see if that happens next year, too. This is one of those things where I think it feels to me a little bit premature, like Apple doing their own custom processors for a Mac. I know they've been working on it for a while. Transitioning from Intel will be a big deal, right? So when this does hit, it'll be big news. And will it happen in 2020? I'm kind of on the fence. I feel 50-50 about it. But what do you think about it? Shoot me some feedback. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. And I guess while we're on the topic of what's next for Apple more immediately, October. Here we are. It's the end of October. We're at the end of October. Invites have not gone out to the press for an October event. A lot of us were expecting something. Maybe it could happen in early November. If Apple is going to move on something like this, it feels like they need to do it sooner than later, right? Because we're getting into the holiday season and they need to get those announcements out there. So will they not have any big announcement? Will they just roll out quietly some updates? I'm kind of feel up in the air. I'm actually frankly surprised that we did not get an October event. And I don't think we're getting one. I mean, here we are. They have literally days and they can't get media together that quickly. So it would have to happen the first or second week of November. If that doesn't happen, my personal opinion is that we don't get another event from Apple this year. They could still roll out some products though, right? We've heard rumors about the 16-inch MacBook Pro. Supposedly it's gone into production. According to reports this week, Quanta is putting those together reportedly for Apple for a release by the end of this month or early November. So they could quietly roll out a new 16-inch MacBook Pro this week, I suppose. Apparently, it's going to be equipped with Intel's Coffee Lake or Ice Lake processors. It's supposed to have an ultra-thin bezel, so while it will be a 16-inch display, most thoughts and most rumors have said it will fit into kind of the form factor of the current 15-inch model, and it is expected to adopt a new redesigned scissor switch keyboard, so Apple moving back to the scissor switches, although with a different design than they've done in the past. And at the price, it's expected to be definitely on the higher end, expected to be priced around $3,000 US to start. So this will be their kind of high-end flagship MacBook Pro. And I'm excited because I'm kind of in the market for a new MacBook Pro. I think I've talked about this on the podcast, and I wouldn't mind getting a little bit larger screen. So I hope it's a product that does happen. The question, again, at this point is, will it be rolled out quietly, or will Apple still have some sort of event? Because there's a number of other products we've been hearing about this year that are still missing. The potential for new AirPods. This is that new design, the in-ear design with the ear tips that would have adaptive noise canceling. According to the Economic Daily News this week, they're saying that it could come in as many as 8 colors. That seems a little bit excessive, but maybe some colors to match the current iPhones, white, black, midnight green, are some of the colors we're hearing about, and that Apple wants to release these in time for the holiday season, and they will come with a more premium price tag, well above the current $200, which is the top end for the AirPods with the wireless charging case. Also, we didn't hear about Apple Tags. This is the new product that Apple's supposed to release that will tie in with the Find My app that will allow you to put little tracking tags and location tags on products, you know, or other things like your keys. And you'll be able to stick these on. They will use the ultra wideband technology that is in the new iPhones to kind of help with that, help you locate your devices and items that you may have misplaced inside your home. So does the little local geolocation tracking using those technologies. We didn't hear about that, and those are expected to be announced. Also, final details on the Mac Pro. What is the actual final specs and pricing? When is the actual product going to be released? We still don't know that. So there's a lot of questions that seem to fit into Apple doing some sort of event. And then finally, of course, updated iPad Pros. Historically, the October event will be all about the iPad and iPad Pros, and we are expecting some updates there as well. So none of this stuff has happened yet. It feels like Apple's running out of time, and a lot of us feel like we're a little bit in the dark. So stay tuned. I think in the next week or two, we will hear something from Apple with regards to some, if not all, of these products. Another product we've been talking about here on the MacCast that we are expecting Apple to update probably sometime early next year is the iPhone SE 2, although as we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast, latest information from Ming-Chi Kuo says it's going to look more like an iPhone 8. So I've been jokingly calling it the iPhone 8 SE 2. But he has updated some information on that product. He says now that it will feature a liquid crystal polymer antenna design for improved wireless transmission. Again, the design is going to be more like an iPhone 8, 4.7-inch display, Touch ID, updated A13 Bionic processor with 3 gigabytes of RAM. It's expected to come in 64 gigabyte and 128 gigabyte storage options and predicted to arrive sometime in the first quarter of 2020 with a price point starting at around $399 US. So it might not even be called the iPhone SE 3, I guess, maybe, or iPhone. Definitely not going to be called the iPhone 8 SE 2. It's expected it could actually be a replacement for the iPhone 8, so might get some name like an iPhone 8S or possibly iPhone 9. Point is this is expected to be Apple's entry-level iPhone with a lot of entry-level features. I think the biggest frustration for folks who are big fans of the smaller size of the iPhone SE is that it will still be that iPhone 8 size, but looking to be a really nice product at a great price point, and it should sell pretty well for Apple if they bring it out in the first half of next year. And then also for 2020, Ben Geskin, Apple leaker, says that Apple is testing a new wider antenna line design on the next generation 5G iPhones, which we're expected to get in 2020. Instead of using the plastic, though, it's looking like those lines are going to use a new material like glass, ceramic, or sapphire. He also says that Apple's longer-term goal is to ditch the Lightning port, but they're not going to be replacing it with USB-C. What they actually want to do is get rid of the port altogether and replace it with an ultra-wideband technology for data transfer. So closing up another port on the iPhone, which I imagine will cause quite a bit of controversy. Will that happen next year? I think it's a possibility, right? Apple has been playing around with the ultra-wideband technology, ultra-wideband tech for USB or wireless USB, as it might be called, is also something that is in the works. So I could see Apple moving in that direction. They've all long wanted to get the iPhone to be just a slab of glass and metal, trying to reduce the number of ports and buttons all the way around. And this would be another step in that direction. So I could see them making that step. He also says they could integrate Face ID and the true depth camera sensors into the bezel of the device. So making that technology, I would assume you'd have to make it a little bit smaller or have a little bit wider bezel, but that could ultimately get rid of the notch that many people have hated for so long. Notch has never really bothered me, but it is something that's bothered quite a few people. And again, getting to kind of a clean design aesthetic, this would be another move in that direction. So that could be what's happening with designs for the iPhone in 2020. But that's kind of some of the latest on what's going on with the October event and why it probably isn't going to happen. Talking about iPhone sales, Rosenblatt Securities thinks that the iPhone 11 has sold almost 12 million units since its launch, and that is a pretty good sales rate. As a matter of fact, they say it puts it 15% ahead of how the sales of the iPhone XR did last year. Overall, they believe that the iPhone 11 and the iPhone 11 Pros will sell roughly 70 million units before the end of the year. And while the iPhone 11 sales seem strong, they don't think that the Pro models are doing quite as well. The report says that sales on those are down 15% versus the rates that they saw for the iPhone XS series phones last year. So doing well on the lower end, not so well on the higher end. That's pretty interesting. Consumer Intelligence Research Partners came in and said that 20% of the iPhones sold in the third quarter of this year were actually the new models, the iPhone 11, iPhone 11 Pros. That's really interesting because those models were only available for 1 week in that quarter. So really strong iPhone sales at the end of the quarter. We often see that, though. It's not that unusual, but you know, 20%, that's great. The breakdown, how was that? 9% of those 20% were iPhone 11s, 6% were iPhone 11 Pros, and just 4% were the iPhone Pro Max. I found that one a little bit interesting because historically the larger phones have been more popular than the smaller ones. But even in our community, I heard a lot of you emailing me saying you were moving back to the smaller phone size, which is interesting because it seems like Apple's still moving in that direction of doing larger and larger phones. We keep hearing that there might be an even bigger iPhone Pro Max next year, and that possibly the iPhone 11 Pro could get a little bit smaller, move in the other direction. So they might be widening that gap between those devices. But these numbers seem to show that people are preferring, at least on the Pro side, the iPhone 11 Pro size versus the Max, which, again, very interesting. Still in that same quarter, 36% of the sales went to the iPhone XR. So you've got 9% on the iPhone 11, 36% on the iPhone XR. And remember, that number is higher because, again, the iPhone 11 wasn't available for more than a week in that quarter. But overall, what's interesting about those numbers to me is it seems to show consumers are being or becoming more price sensitive when it comes to iPhones and updating iPhones and what the new features are. That, you know, it's possible Apple is making the lower end phones too good? No, I don't really think that's the case. But I mean, consumers are responding to that. They're seeing that the iPhone 11 is a great model. It has a lot of great high-end features. It's got the same processor as the Pro models, and it's at a much more reasonable price. I'm going to avoid saying cheap or affordable because we know iPhones are expensive, but consumers are responding to that. And I think consumers are recognizing they don't necessarily need a lot of those top high-end features, and they're not as much willing to pay for them. And so the big question becomes, what does that mean for Apple's bottom line? We know Apple is very healthy right now. The company's doing very well. I don't think it's doom and gloom, but it does sort of point to the fact that, and we've seen this in the numbers, that the average selling price of an iPhone is moving down, despite the fact that Apple keeps raising the prices on the higher end. And I think that's all consumer reaction, right? We're seeing how consumers are responding to the market. And I can tell you, just from those of you I hear from in our community, a lot of you did opt to upgrade, say, from an iPhone XS or a XS Max to an iPhone 11. There's a lot of people opting in for the lower priced model because it has such great features and functionality, and they don't necessarily need to pay that high-end premium Pro price. So it's interesting to see how the market is shaping up with regard to iPhone. I think things like the update to the iPhone SE2 that we just talked about, I think that's another indication that Apple understands that consumers on the lower to mid end of the market, they are very important, and Apple needs to cater to them. So I think a lot of these products and designs are speaking to that. And I also think that these numbers are showing that that's how the market is responding. Apple Pay has become the top mobile payment platform in the U.S., at least according to recent data from eMarketer. They claim that Apple Pay now has 30.3 million users in the U.S., or will have 30.3 million users in the U.S. in 2019. That represents about 47.3% of mobile payment users, beating out the previous top contender, which was Starbucks. A lot of people use that Starbucks app for making mobile payments in the U.S. But Apple is ahead of them now, according to this data. And what has really helped? I think more retailers supporting Apple Pay. This is something that I talked about on the MacCast many times. In the early days, it was pretty frustrating when you would go into a retailer, ask if you could use Apple Pay, and you were told no. I think that is definitely changing. It's changed over the last 3 to 6 months. At least in my experience, I've been going into more retailers and getting yes, although I still hear a lot that they'll say, well, yeah, we can do Samsung Pay, but we can't do Apple Pay. And that, as you know, if you've been listening to the show for a while, is due to the fact that Samsung uses a technology that can leverage the magnetic stripe readers on the phone. It's not a pure chip contactless NFC payment system. It's kind of a hybrid system that they adapted. So retailers don't have to have newer terminals. But what's happening here in the U.S. is as retailers get newer terminals that support the technology, it is being enabled. I think there's been also some support from Apple with retailers, and it is predicted that Apple Pay will be available in 70% of U.S. retailers by the end of 2019. So I think that's definitely helping. I am trying to use Apple Pay more and more. I think it is still one of the best experiences for doing payments. I much prefer it to pulling out my credit card and having to put it in the chip reader, anything like that. And I think this kind of growth and support for Apple Pay is showing that a lot of other consumers feel the same way. So have you noticed this? Have you noticed that Apple Pay is being accepted more places and more readily available for you to use? Let me know your experiences. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. We talked in the last episode of the MacCast about the fact that Apple has started to produce its own shows for its Apple TV Plus service. They were just sort of ordering shows from other studios, but Apple is starting to form their own studio, and they're going to be producing their own content. This was actually something, it turns out, that Apple wanted to try to do from the very beginning, at least according to Bloomberg. They say that Apple pursued buying Imagine Entertainment, the studio founded by Ron Howard and Brian Grazier. But Grazier and Howard ultimately said no to the buyout. They didn't want to be working for a larger company. So Apple sort of rethought things and ultimately started ordering original series from other studios. And then ultimately, as we know now, formed their own in-house studio. So the good news is, out of all of these negotiations, they did get a first look deal with Imagine for their documentary projects. So we could still see some Imagine Entertainment content coming to Apple TV. As far as how Apple TV might fare, Morgan Stanley's Katie Huberty thinks that Apple TV Plus could bring in $9 billion in revenue by 2025. This assumes that just one out of every 10 Apple users winds up paying for the new subscription service. The free year and the low price should help convert customers. I think that's going to go a long way to getting people into the program. One in 10 doesn't seem that ambitious to me, so that feels really realistic in terms of how the numbers might play out. It's also predicted that Apple will see a 20% growth in services next year, and we've been seeing that kind of growth with Apple services over the past year or so. So I think that will definitely continue. I think it might even be a little bit conservative, especially considering that you've got more and more services like Apple Arcade, the Apple News service, Apple TV Plus, and the rumors that Apple could ultimately do a bundled deal for all this stuff, I think might even sign up more consumers. And of course, Apple Music. We can't forget Apple Music, the first kind of successful subscription service outside of iCloud that Apple put together. So Apple really focusing on services. As you know, my opinion is that's kind of the transition thing that will get them from iPhone to the next big thing, which might be that AR headset or some other thing from Apple. But not bad to have 20, 30% growth in an area of your business and ultimately be generating, you know, $9 billion in revenue. So that's really, really good for Apple. One other thing in Apple TV Plus news that I want to talk about, something that I am frankly a little bit disappointed about, if I have to be honest with myself, but it's the fact that Apple did not go family friendly on the new TV service. This was something that was rumored, that Apple was trying to be a little bit more conservative with their content, avoid some more of the heavy adult themes, violence, sex, all those sorts of things in their programming. It's now pretty much been confirmed that that wasn't the case. They've been doing a few early premieres of some of their shows at festivals, including a showing of the new series C with Jason Momoa. And reviewers have said it definitely has adult themes with graphic violence and those sorts of things. The reviewer notes that the scenes, quote, fit within the plot of the story and help shape the personality of the characters, but definitely this programming is not for all ages. If you look on Apple's website at some of the marketing for the shows, you can see that many of the shows come with TVMA ratings, 18 or over in the US, 15 or over in the UK. And also some of their film projects are still rated R. So definitely not all family-friendly content. They have some family-friendly content, but it does feel like more of it is trending into that just for adults only area. And like I said, I can't say I'm not a little bit personally disappointed. C looks like a great epic drama, and the fact that I'm not going to be able to enjoy it with all of my family is a little bit disappointing to me. And it's not that I don't enjoy or watch adult level shows. I do. I enjoy very much of that. It's just that I feel that there are many of these shows that could back off on some of the graphic adult themes, sex, and content, and they would bring them into a more broader audience range without harming the narrative of the show, and you know, more of us could enjoy it. And these are great stories. I guess that's part of my frustration, is so many of these things have great stories, great character development, and a lot of it's ruined, frankly, if in my opinion, by moving it heavily into those adult areas when it doesn't need to. I'm all for it when it sort of services the story, but more often than not, it really doesn't. Now, it was good to hear from this reviewer that he did feel that it was in service of the story in the case of C, but I know I'm going to have to start watching these programs and forming my own opinion. They're going to be here soon. And that's fine. What's really odd to me about this too, especially when it comes to TV content, is this seems to be the opposite of movies and films, right? Movies are often going for that PG-13 rating. They're riding that edge, but they're always kind of pushing it, you know, down a little bit. And I just wish we saw more of that on TV. There's a lot of great adult level content out there, and it seemed like an opportunity for Apple, especially given sort of their brand history and that sort of thing, to bring something to the market that was a little bit different, that had a broader appeal to a wider range of audience members. And I think ultimately that would be good for, you know, driving subscription services. If there's more content available to a broader range of audience members, that feels like it would be good for a subscription service and not necessarily bad. So again, I'm reserving judgment till we actually see these shows. I don't know, you know, where it falls compared to, say, like an HBO or a Showtime, something like that, in terms of the adultness of the content. But for now, we are seeing, and this is good news for a lot of people. A lot of people were worried that it was going to water down the content if the creators were sort of restricted or limited by what Apple wanted to do on their service. That's not sounding like it's the case, that it's not that way, despite what we had sort of been hearing. So we'll have to all kind of watch them and form an opinion. And luckily for us, this content will be here soon. It's due out November 1st. And then finally in the news for this week, if you own an older iPhone, an iPhone 5, then it's time to make sure that you're up to date with your OS. You need to make sure that you update your iPhone 5 or your fourth generation iPad with Wi-Fi and cellular to at least iOS 10.3.4 before November 3rd if you want to be able to continue to use the App Store for updates and iCloud. This update was actually released back in July, so I would assume many of you have it already. And it also addressed some GPS issues, but you are going to need to be on that latest version. If not, if you wait too long to upgrade, then you are going to have to back up and restore your device from a Mac or PC, since the over-the-air updates will no longer work. So if you want to update it after November 3rd and you haven't, it's going to be a little bit more difficult. It does look like only the iPhone 5 needs the update to maintain App Store or iCloud compatibility, but that GPS issue was updated on several devices, again, including the fourth generation iPad Wi-Fi with cellular, the iPad 2 with Wi-Fi and cellular, the third generation iPad with Wi-Fi and cellular. All of those you want to make sure that you update. On those older ones, the iPhone 4, the first generation iPad mini, all those you will update to iOS 9.3.6. That update came out. So 10.3.4, iOS 9.3.6, basically the latest version of whatever the last version of the operating system your device could run on, is what you're going to want to make sure you update to before the end of November 3rd. Older iPod Touch models or iPad models that are Wi-Fi only don't require this update for the GPS fixes, because they don't have GPSs. That's part of that cellular chip. So don't need to worry about that there. These are just for those devices. But the big one here is the iPhone 5, especially if you want to continue to get over-the-air updates. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a moment and thank a couple show sponsors, starting with Mint Mobile. Hey, are you a little bit frustrated like I am with the costs of cellular service? Yeah, we're paying for a lot of overhead and retail with really big companies, and Mint Mobile has a solution that takes care of a lot of this. They provide the same premium coverage that you're used to, but at a fraction of the cost, because they handle and do everything online. They save on retail locations and overhead, and they pass those savings directly on to you. They also give you all the services and features you need without all of the extras that you don't, that in addition helps cut costs, and they pass those savings on to you. Why pay for a bunch of data that you never use? Some of these data plans are getting massive, and most of us don't use that much data. Mint offers plans with 3, 8, or 12 gigabytes of data starting at just $15 a month. Yeah, can you imagine? $15 a month. They offer it. And yes, that's nationwide talk and text and Hotspot. You get, like I said, all the features that you want at a really great price. I've been using Mint Mobile, and the coverage and performance has been great. Not that surprising, though, because they use T-Mobile for their service network. You can bring your own device. You can even keep the same phone number you have, and they make the process of transitioning from your old service to Mint Mobile super easy. You get a kit with everything you need. It's got the SIM. Pop it in there. You activate it online. I was up and running in a matter of minutes, and everything worked out of the box, no problems. Get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free. Go to mintmobile.com/maccast. That's mintmobile.com/maccast. And a big thank you to them for their support of the show. I'd also like to thank MasterClass. MasterClass offers online classes that let you learn from the best. They offer exclusive access to online courses taught by masters of their craft. And one of my favorite things about MasterClass is the amazing depth and variety of the courses that they offer. No other place are you going to find access to this kind of talent. And the quality of the courses is also amazing. Some of the best I've ever seen. They each have their own unique style, which I think keeps it really interesting, and they offer their courses in small chunks, little lessons, typically 10 to 15 minutes, so you can easily fit them into your schedule, and it's made even easier by the fact that you can access them from any device, your iPhone, your iPad, your Mac, your Apple TV. You can start one place, pick right up where you left off. And what I'm finding as I take more and more masterclasses is that a lot of what I'm learning, I can easily adapt to my own field and the stuff that I do in my own life. Maybe the course isn't specifically about my field, but it has applications in the stuff I do. And I'll give you an example. I love games and gaming. Actually, I want to make games at some point. So when I saw that Will Wright, the designer of The Sims, had a course on MasterClass on game development, I thought, hey, I'll check this one out. And I was really enjoying his lesson on early prototyping for games. Now, he's talking about video games, but it really got me thinking about ways that I could use the concepts and the ideas with my clients in developing and prototyping websites. So with MasterClass, I found that often I'll get into a course thinking about one thing, but ideas and concepts and just the creative thinking and just the kinds of folks that you're learning from, it's so inspiring. And I immediately want to go out and start applying these concepts. And so while you can get courses individually, I really love having the all-access pass because it allows me to go through and explore all of these different courses. They have over 60 different classes, and they're constantly adding more, so I really think it's a great investment in your professional development and learning. And now you can have unlimited access to every masterclass as a MacCast listener. You'll get $30 off. I highly recommend you check it out. Get unlimited access to every masterclass as a MacCast listener. You get 15% off the annual all-access pass. Just go to masterclass.com/MacCast. That's masterclass.com/MacCast for 15% off MasterClass. And a huge thank you to them for their support of the show. Turns out my tip and advice on getting older versions of macOS and downloading them from Apple that I gave out on the last episode of the MacCast almost worked. We were talking about the fact that with the update to macOS Catalina, it used to be that you could go into the App Store, the Mac App Store, and look in your purchases. And if you had downloaded a version, an older version of Mac operating system, it was there and available to re-download in your purchase section. That is no longer working, and a listener had asked about that, and I found a page on Apple's support website that talked about creating a bootable USB installer, and then from that page, they had links to all of the various older versions of Mac OS, going all the way back to, I want to say, Yosemite, maybe even back further than that. And I had tested a few of the links. They worked for me, but they were more recent links. And it turns out, and many of you emailed me about this, is it seems like you could go back to about High Sierra if you were running Mac OS Catalina or Mojave. But after that, some of the links seemed to fail. They didn't seem to actually work. You would go, it would launch the App Store, and then it would say that version was not available. So if you were trying to grab like Sierra or Yosemite or something like that, the links were not working for some folks. And so what we discovered was that they seemed to be, or they seemed to depend on, rather, which version of the operating system you're on with how far back you can go. So the workaround, and kudos to a couple listeners who kind of discovered this, the workaround seems to be that if you need to get an older version of one of the Mac operating systems, what you have to do is basically boot into a version that's a little bit older than your current version. And the easiest way to probably do this is to use one of the older installers that you already have to create or install Mac OS on a USB stick. And then you can basically boot from that USB stick and then go download the older versions of Mac OS. So you have to do a little bit of Mac OS inception to go back and get these older installers. And it's unfortunate that Apple is sort of making us jump through these additional hoops. I don't know why, especially given the fact that the operating systems are free, why they can't just make these available as simple downloads from their website. There's not a lot of reason, and a lot of people have asked me, Adam, why do you even need older versions of Mac OS or Mac OS installers? And one, it's just, I don't know, I'm a collector. I like to know that I have these things. I have a little tin that has a USB stick with every version of the Mac operating system since they stopped giving out CDs. And frankly, I'll tell you, I have a DVD collection with every version. I have every version of Mac OS going all the way back to 10.0. So I guess at this point, part of it is just having a collection, knowing that I have all of these installers. Whether I'll ever use them or not, I don't know. But I will tell you, it has come up. I've had people come to me, friends, usually people through my user group. They've received an older Mac or something like that, and they want to get it back up and running. And it might only run, you know, a certain version of the Mac operating system. And it's nice to be able to tell them, yep, I have a version of that. Or I have some older machines. You know, I do have a 2006 Mac Mini that is stuck on Snow Leopard, I think is the version. And it's nice to know that I have the DVD for that. So, you know, it's just nice to have. If you want them, it's nice to have a way to get them. And that was kind of why I was sharing that information on the previous shows. But sorry, apologies for some of the frustration that some of you experienced. Hopefully, this little tip now will kind of round the whole thing out and allow you to go get the version of Mac OS that you want to download. Not long after the release of the iPhone 11, the iPhone 11 Pros, you probably noticed, I definitely noticed, that there started to be reports of people saying that their screens were scratching, and some people saying that this happened within days or even hours of getting their new phones. Now, I did not bring this up on the MacCast. I generally avoided talking about it because these things are often reported like there's some sort of epidemic going on when that's really not the case. And it wasn't really clear that this was worse or any bigger of a problem than it had been with prior generation models of the iPhone. A lot of people were alleging that, but I was having a hard time finding any sort of hard evidence to back that up. And I think the story was also blowing up a little bit because Apple made a really big deal at their event and with their marketing that this was the toughest glass that they ever put in an iPhone. The thing about that, though, is they were really talking about the breakability. Should you drop it, it's supposed to, you know, be more durable. Now, we know from drop tests that even that might be a little bit in question, but the concept was it's less breakable, not necessarily more scratch resistant. And from some of the research that I've been doing, it does seem too like when you make the glass less breakable, more shatter resistant, there is a challenge with keeping the scratch resistance. Although, again, I haven't seen any hard evidence that anything has really changed in terms of the scratch resistance of Apple Glass over the prior few generations of iPhones. That said, though, I mention this now because I did get a report from one member of the MacCast community this week via email that he had a scratch on his iPhone 11. And he didn't put a case on it. He's never historically used a case or rather screen protector. But this was unusual for him. And he's very careful about his device. This is somebody who's been in our community for a long time. I completely trust him in terms of the reporting of the issue. And so it was just a little bit unusual. And so it got me thinking, is this really a problem? Is there something systemically wrong with the glass on the iPhone 11 that is allowing it to scratch more easily? And I think we need more data points. And so I'm bringing it up so that we can throw it out to the community. You know, I have one iPhone. This is one report. So I have one experience. This listener shared one experience. I received a ton of emails about this issue, but mostly from those of you in the community who are saying, I'm afraid to buy an iPhone 11. I'm afraid to upgrade because I love my iPhone 10 or I love my iPhone 8 and I don't have scratching problems. And I'm afraid that if I upgrade, I'm going to get scratches on my device and I don't want to have to buy a screen protector to protect it. So I'm bringing it up on the show now because it's come up in our community with somebody I really trust who said, I had this problem. Now for him, he just took it back to Apple. They happily replaced it, but that's not the experience that a lot of people are reporting. A lot of people are reporting pushback that Apple's saying that it's user damage. And typically, historically, that is how they handled it. So my question to you is this a systemic problem? Is this a huge, massive issue? There are a number of long support threads on Apple's forums. So it's definitely happening to people. I don't think it's not, you know, but the question it has become, is it worse than it has been in the past? In looking at the evidence, if I'm trying to be purely scientific about it, I can tell you, you know, Jerry Rig Everything, a YouTuber, he always does these scratch tests on the iPhone. He takes things like razor blades and keys and tries to scratch the display. It generally holds up against that. He also does hardness picks, which use the Mohs scale, and these are standard tools for testing the hardness of materials. And they scratched the iPhone 11 screens, scratched at the same hardness level as they have in years past. So scientifically, it doesn't seem like these displays are more or less susceptible to scratching than they have been in the past. But if you go again, look at these threads, and there's some pretty nasty photos on there of iPhones with horrendous scratching on them. The issues being reported seem to be more on the iPhone 11 models than the iPhone 11 Pro, but we are seeing reports of both getting scratches. For my part, I can only speak to my personal experience. I've had my iPhone 11 Pro since day one. I do not use a screen protector. I do put my iPhone in my pocket. I set it face down on surfaces. I am very careful when I put it in my pocket to put it in a pocket that doesn't have any other items in it. No coins, no keys, nothing like that. And I do not have any scratches on my iPhone screen. Now, that said, I can tell you also that I don't use screen protectors on any of my iPhones. I never have, and that every iPhone that I've ever owned has ended up at some point with at least a scratch or two, nothing major, but at least a scratch or two on the screen. I chalk it up to normal wear and tear, and if I really was concerned about it, I would use a screen protector. But I use my phones, I buy my phones, they're meant to be daily drivers and devices, and I do expect a certain amount of wear and tear. Now, it is not normal for you to take an iPhone out of the box and have a scratch on it. It is probably not normal for you to get a scratch on an iPhone that you're being gingerly careful with. But if you have an iPhone and it winds up in your pocket with some keys or some coins, it gets jostled around, maybe it gets dropped, it can scratch. It is not scratch proof. And I don't think anybody's alleging that. But again, the question in my mind becomes, is there something wrong with the iPhone 11s that are causing them to scratch more readily? Some people have argued that it might be scratches in the coatings, the oleophobic coatings or the other coatings that are on the glass. I don't think that's the case this time around. The scratches that we're hearing reported are pretty deep. They tend to be in the glass. And like I said, they do. You can get scratches in your glass. I've had them. It's not a rarity. And the question then becomes, is it better or worse? I threw this out in the Patreon Slack channel that we have, and I didn't get a lot of responses from anyone saying that their devices were scratched. So I'm throwing it out to you in the broader community. We have, you know, thousands of listeners, tens of thousands of listeners picking up this program. So have you had issues with your iPhone 11, iPhone 11 Pro with scratching? Has your experience been better or worse or the same as with previous iPhones? Let me know, shoot me an email or a comment, and we'll try to get to the bottom of this, maccast@gmail.com. I want to talk about some photography on the iPhone 11 and the new night mode, specifically as it applies to older iPhones. And some of you might already be knowing where we're going with this, and you're thinking, Adam, older iPhones, I don't think they support night mode. And others of you are probably going, wait a minute, I have an older iPhone. I upgraded to iOS 13. I thought I had night mode. So there seems to be some general confusion. And I'm bringing this up because I received a few emails from listeners with older devices who thought that night mode would be available on their devices after upgrading to iOS 13. And I just want to clear up the sort of confusion a little bit. And I think Apple may have caused a little bit of this confusion. I actually went back and watched the iPhone 11 announcements that Apple made at their special event. And the way they talked about night mode is that they really kind of focused on some of the software features, the computational photography portions of the technology. And even though they were talking about it at an iPhone event and not at Worldwide Developer Conference, where they focus more on the operating system and the software, it did make it sound like this might be a software feature. So I think it's reasonable that some people in the community might have assumed that, hey, yes, it's a new feature on the iPhone 11, but it's not hardware related. So I could get this with the iOS 13 update. That, as many of you know, is not the case. Night mode does require hardware as well. It requires a new iPhone, an iPhone 11, an iPhone 11 Pro, or Pro Max. And the reason is, like with a lot of Apple products, the technology relies on a combination of hardware and software. So it's not just the computational photography. In this case, the hardware that's involved, it is a new image sensor. The wide angle lens is actually a new sensor. Apple didn't really focus on this, though. And if you look purely at the tech specs on Apple's website, the wide angle lens in the iPhone XS seems to be the same specs as the wide angle lens in the iPhone 11 and the 11 Pro. But Apple has said in some interviews that it's not. It actually is a new sensor, and this new sensor is able to capture more light than previous generation sensors. The night mode also relies on the processor, the A13 Bionic chip and its neural engine. There's more power, there's more features in there that are leveraged to help night mode do its magic. And then also, it needs the optical image stabilization of the camera module as well. And that is why it's limited to just the wide angle lens. You can only use night mode with the wide angle lens in the iPhone 11, and that's because you need to hold really steady, because it's going to take a series of exposures, some longer, some shorter, but you have to hold very still. And that's why another bit of advice, if you want to get really good night mode shots on your iPhone, is to stabilize your iPhone in some way. Use a tripod, a monopod, put it on a stable surface. You're going to get better quality shots. You can get them handheld because it does use the optical image stabilization in the lens, but the sort of steadier you can hold the iPhone, the better. And so night mode only works on the iPhone Series 11 phones, only with the 1X lens. And I think we talked about this a little bit, but we'll just finish up by mentioning how you use night mode. So on an if you have an iPhone 11, iPhone 11 Pro model, night mode will actually automatically engage when it detects that you're in a situation that would require it. So it will come on, you'll see a little yellow icon. It'll usually say the number of seconds that it's going to take the shot. So 1 to 3 seconds, typically in the exposure. You'll have a little yellow icon show up. It looks like a moon icon. You can actually tap on that icon, the little yellow moon icon, to bring up the controls, and you can use the slider. There's a little slider there you can use to control whether night mode is on or off, and you can even increase the timing of the night mode and how much it's going to apply. And so you can play with that. And what happens then with night mode enabled when you tap the shutter is you'll see you get a countdown. It'll sort of count down the seconds. You even get a little animation along with that. And it's taking that series of exposures. And that's when it's really important that you don't move. I will give you a little tip, though. If you want to play around with this, especially if you're doing like a night mode shot and you want to get like light trails and stuff like that, you can actually move the iPhone as it's doing the exposure, and you can get some neat little effects too. So that's kind of fun to play around with just artistically. But if you want to get a really good night mode shot, you're going to want to hold still while it does that countdown. And that's how you use night mode. And it's also why night mode is unfortunately limited to only the newer model iPhones. And so it's not like a lot of conspiracy theories are out there trying to imply, simply so that Apple can charge you more for a new phone. There's actually hardware and software working in conjunction to get that feature to work. I'm pretty excited. We are now literally days away. Might even, by the time you hear this podcast, be past the day when Apple TV Plus launches. We've been talking about it for a long time. Apple has announced it. November 1st is the release date for Apple TV Plus, and I am looking very much forward to getting in and checking out this new content. I'm also very excited about the fact that because I buy Apple products and have recently bought some new products, that my first year is going to be free. I'm not even going to have to pay the $4.99 a month to get the service for the first year, which is awesome. But many of you, including Avner, have a question about that. And here's what Avner had to say.
Hi, Adam. This is Avner from Northern California here. I recently bought a new iPhone for my wife, and I was wondering, how can I use it to get the Apple TV Plus subscription? Do I have to wait till November 1st for the service to come out? I couldn't see any link or anything. Thanks. That would be helpful.
Hey, Avner, I will try to help you out here. And you are definitely not alone in wondering about this. I have received many emails over the past week or so with folks asking this exact same question, because a lot of people have upgraded their iPhones. They bought a new Apple TV. They bought a new iPad. And for those of you who maybe aren't in the loop, what's happening here is Apple TV Plus is coming out on November 1st. If you have purchased a Mac, an iPad, an iPhone, an Apple TV recently, then you qualify to get a free year of Apple TV Plus service. And the question then becomes, great, I bought this device, I bought this product in the last few months. How do I get that free service? Is there a coupon I redeem? What do I actually do? And luckily, Avner, for you and the rest of you out there, there is a support article up on Apple's website right now that explains it. I will link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But just to give you the info, after November 1st, 2019, what you can do is you can turn on your new iPad, your iPhone, your Apple TV Plus, your Apple TV HD, or your Mac, sign in with your Apple TV, and then open up the, or with your Apple ID rather, excuse me, open up the Apple TV app on November 1st or later, and just make sure that your eligible device is running the latest version of the operating system. And what should happen is the offer should be presented to you immediately after launching the app. If you don't see that, scroll down to the watch into the Watch Now section until you see the offer appear, and then you'll be able to tap Enjoy 1 year Free. And you might be asked to enter your Apple ID and password again to confirm your billing information or make sure that you have a valid payment method on your account. You do need to have a valid payment method on your account, because after your first year of service, you are going to be automatically charged. So that needs to be set up. But as long as you have all those elements in play, that's how it's supposed to work. Now, I assume that for this to work, you would need to have registered that device with your Apple ID, otherwise, or purchased it with that Apple ID. Otherwise, I'm not sure how Apple would make the connection back. So I'm assuming there's some folks that are going to run into trouble where maybe the device isn't registered under the same Apple ID that they're using on their Mac or whatever it might be. But assuming all those things link up, seems like this should happen automatically. The offer should be presented to you after November 1st when you launch the Apple TV app. That's in a perfect world. So that's how you do it. We'll find out for sure after November 1st. I do want to bring up a few other things that are mentioned in this article, because I'm not entirely certain that Apple made these clear about this offer as well. And there was some confusion, and I had some of these questions myself. So the 1 year free offer is a one time only offer. You only get one free year, and you only get it once per household. So if you have a family sharing account, you're only going to get 1 year of free service for your entire family. It doesn't matter how many Apple IDs you have or how many Apple products you've purchased. It's not per Apple product. It's per family, per household. So one offer per Apple ID and only one per family if you're in a family sharing group. So if you have multiple IDs and you're not in the same family, then fine. It's one per Apple ID. But if you're using family sharing, just be aware of that. It doesn't matter how many devices you or your family have purchased. Also, on signing up, you commit to the monthly subscription rate. That's $4.99 in the U.S. It'll vary depending upon your region. And the payments are going to automatically start after that first free year. Now, you can cancel at any time during your free year of service up to and including the day before your renewal date, and you're not going to get charged. But you need to be careful with that, because unlike some of Apple's other subscription services, with Apple TV Plus, if you cancel during your free year, the cancellation happens immediately and you can't re-sign up for the free service. It says, quote, if you cancel during your free year and you and your family members, or you and your family members, will immediately lose access to Apple TV Plus and the remainder of your 1 year free trial. You can't reactivate this trial. So you don't want to sign up and then immediately cancel. Don't do that. You're going to have to wait until your year is almost up before you do the cancellation if you don't want to continue with the service. So I would recommend probably the day you sign up, set a reminder in your calendar for 1 day before your subscription is going to renew, and make sure you cancel then if you want to cancel the service. So just be aware of that. I'd hate for anyone to get caught off guard or lose their free year of access just because they canceled too early. So that's how it will all work, supposedly, Avner. Again, in practice, sometimes this ends up being different, a little bit different for people, and experiences are probably going to vary. But in Apple's world, this is how it's supposed to work. And we'll find out here in a couple days. And I'll be curious also to get some feedback from many of you as you start to watch some of Apple's new programming and content, what you think about that. Of course, I will share my opinions as I start to watch these shows and maybe even make some recommendations on future episodes of the MacCast. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a moment and thank a show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander and PDF Pen for Mac. Also, PDF Pen and Text Expander for iOS, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline, that phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM. Nine. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.